Public testimony was taken on this, and we closed the public testimony. The bill is in front of us. I don't believe there's any amendments. We did have further discussions with the sponsor on it. I have no other questions. Do any members have any questions? Any additional questions on House Bill 324? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Stokes. Oh, for the record, Representative Katula is with this also.
You want a motion?
Yes, please.
Mr. Chairman, I move that CS for House Bill number 324, the Resource 24 LS 1218-F, be moved from committee with the attached zero fiscal note with individual recommendations and the blessing of Mr. Holt.
And I object.
Okay. You object?
Yeah, and I'd just like to speak to my objection, and then I'll remove my objection, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
In the interim, since the last time we heard this, we did some analysis of what other laws are around the state of the United States. And I pulled up the Invasive Species Council that list from the state of Oregon, which happens, as we all know, to be a pretty green state. In the Oregon list, they have over 100 invasive species, and Lithrum is not even listed. In fact, if you look at Oregon's invasive species list, it includes things like foxglove, a number of things that we grow in Alaska as for the purpose of perennials and so forth and so on. Granted, there's Canadian thistle and those things which are terribly invasive. But my point here is that I've also looked in Oregon's penalties and what they do. What Oregon does is they have an invasive species council, which is given the responsibility of eradication, quarantine, and identification of invasive species. And Mr. Chairman, they have in their process, in their regulatory process, they have a generic plan for new invasion and so forth and so on. And enforcement is, as they notice, is the weakest link in Oregon's invasive species defense. The state relies heavily on voluntary compliance, not on making it something where we can put people in jail. The action list does not include putting people in jail, period. It also does not impose fines. What it does is it says, look, we need a solution. We go out and we define where these things are, and then we go and we fix it. And Mr. Chairman, that's the reason that I just think that this bill is just bad policy for the state of Alaska. And with that, I'll remove my objection.
Objections removed. Any other objection to the bill? Representative Kelly?
Mr. Chairman, just on the issue of...
So you object then?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Just for the question of regulation versus the law that we talked about last time, and I'm trying to remember what the question was when I spoke to you this morning. Did that get fleshed out a bit, and was the decision made that we need law rather than regulation on this, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Kelly, yes, Representative Holman and myself did the sponsor Ledoux. It's my understanding that it could go either way. It could be done through regulations or it could be done by statute. And I left it up to the sponsor as to which way she preferred, and she would still like to see it go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is that correct? No, I put words in your mouth. Okay, do you remove your objection? Okay, any objection?
Object for comment?
Okay, go ahead for comment.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Following Representative Kelly's discussion there, that makes sense. We have regulatory authority to regulate this, and the regulators have chosen not to. The question is, do we want to impose by statute a decision upon the department who has, for whatever reason, not complied with the wishes of the sponsors of this bill? Likewise, I think this just gets into a bad direction of public policy of imposing sort of decisions and imposing political decisions on what is ought to be a scientific determination, an issue decided on its merits in a scientific forum rather than a political forum. I will also, like I said, not to fight this out of here, but I just don't see this as being a good policy direction for the legislature to invest itself in. But that also might remove my objection.
Thank you, Rick. So, Harper. Anybody else would like to object?
Okay, no other objections. Bill passes out of committee. Okay, let's take a brief Eddie's here.
House Bill 399, Elder Fraud and Assistance. Let's see. I believe I'm going to need a motion to get a blank committee substitute.
I will. Mr. Chairman, I make the motion to adopt the blank committee substitute for House Bill 399. Version 24-LS1517/F. Miskell, 306/06 is the working document before the committee.
Object? Okay, let's say home, your objection?
Just because I could. I'll revoke my objection.
Okay, thank you. That's
it. Right.
All right. So we have the F version in front of us, and I understand here that Ms. Rice, you're going to be doing the presenting, or Ms. Snyder, 142, or maybe both.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Sue Rice, Finance Commissioner. Undoubtedly, one of the saddest times days that I've had in my legislative career, which has been over the course of over 15 years, is the day that I re-met Joyce and Sam McDowell from Sterling, Alaska. And the more that I got to know what Joyce and Sam were going through, the more alarmed that I was that they were victims of a distant relative committing the most egregious act of fraud that I've ever seen on the elderly in Alaska. I believe Dan McDowell is online, and perhaps he will be brief in explaining just how far and extensive this fraud was. It invaded millions of dollars of property. It culminated in an eviction, the entire gutting of their home, making it unlivable, and to the point where we had asked every state agency available that I knew how to ask for help and assistance for these people, because this relative just came in and disabled them financially. Fortunately, Josh Fink rose to the occasion and was able to stop the eviction and start unwinding this tangled web that this distant relative has weaved and created such a mess and a problem for these folks. With that, I'd like to turn this over to Lorena Snyder, who's worked on this bill in conjunction with a former staff member who was a law school graduate and Josh Fink. But I'm asking you to pay particular attention to what Dan McDowell has to say, because he is directly involved with his parents' estate. And it's property not only from the Kenai, but it's property all over the state of Alaska. And this is just the biggest mess I've ever seen. Unfortunately, Josh has come in to try to fix that. And we just need some teeth to align to it. So with that, I'm going to excuse myself from these two fine people. And Dan, and
okay. Thank you, Ms. Wright. Any questions for Ms. Wright?
We do have Mr. McDowell online to testify as we move along here. Okay, Ms. Snyder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman Lainey Snyder, staff representative Mike Schnell. Today I'd just like to talk about the art poll that's included in your packet with Cypress, Stolt, and Goldman. As Sue mentioned, this bill is a result of financial exploitation of an elderly couple. This is a growing trend. Financial abuse takes many forms, including credit card fraud, real estate scams, identity theft, and burglary, and reports of financial exploitation on the rise. 40% of all reported elder abuse cases involve financial exploitation, yet only a small number of these cases are reported. A study conducted by the National Center on Elder Abuse found that for every reported case of elder abuse, another 5 cases went unreported. Effective state responses to financial exploitation require collaboration by a range of state and local agencies, including law enforcement, adult protective services, victim service agencies, and private partners. However, coordination remains a major challenge, and the lack of interagency coordination means that victims remain hidden. This bill would help ensure the necessary coordination among agencies to address this problem. Establishing the Office of Elder Fraud Resistance would give elderly residents the last of the appropriate protection they deserve. Just appreciate your support.
Very good. Any questions for Ms. Snyder? Okay. Seeing none, Mr. Fink, are you?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay. For the record, my name is Josh Fink, I'm the Director of the Office of Public Advocacy. And I'll try to keep my comments brief on these questions. I would like to commend the sponsors for introducing this legislation that addresses what is a growing problem here in Alaska, that the financial exploitation of elder Alaskans, vulnerable Alaskans, and this specifically addresses elder Alaskans. While we do have a myriad of state agencies that one can report these incidents to, with one possible exception, there currently is no agency that's authorized to actively pursue civil remedies on behalf of an exploited individual. In talking with the lead agency on processing and investigating these reports of harm to Adult Protective Services, however, they don't have statutory authority to sue on behalf of the individuals. What they will do is they'll come in and stop the exploitation by possibly filing a petition to the court for protective order of conservatorship or guardianship, and so they can stop the future exploitation. They have no ability to go back in and recoup the losses. According to Brent Malatini, who I've been working closely with, the director of Adult Protective Services, in fiscal year 2005, there were 500 cases of financial abuse exploitation. A hand count from 2004, they still have a new system, a hand count from 2004 shows 397 cases. So you can see there was a 103 case increase, I mean significant, from 2004 to 2005. Of those cases, approximately 90% were verified and found to have been valid cases of financial exploitation. When Adult Protective Services gets these, they try to shop the cases around to Alaska Legal Services, Disability Law Center. Anybody will take them. They have not been successful in getting these nonprofits to accept these cases. They can be complicated. They can be fact and audit intensive. And they don't have the resources to do it. This legislation would empower OPA to do that for those over 60, and it specifies we would be providing a pursuit on behalf of the individuals for those who are not otherwise able to bring a complaint without assistance, and we would define that regulation, probably model it after the definition of vulnerable Alaskans, which is currently a statute. The legislation also requires us to work with local, state, national law enforcement, social service agencies to come up with cooperative agreements. So I envision that we would have agreements with Adult Protective Services who would screen cases, make referrals to OPA. We'd also have agreements with law enforcement agencies so as not to interfere in ongoing communication or jeopardize that. And the other state agencies, Department of Commerce, you've got securities and insurance that receives complaints, again, can't sue on behalf of individuals. We'd have agreements with them as well. Finally, the legislation allows us to recoup costs if it doesn't create a financial hardship to the individual we're suing on behalf of. So it's an ability to pay issue. We currently do this with our public guardian clients. Statute allows us to collect fees unless it causes a financial hardship. we waive fees where it causes such hardships. With regard to, I understand that Representative Hawker had some concern with regard to statutory authority to collect fees, and there are provisions that allow us to collect fees. For parents, we represent child matters. For criminal defendants, the public defender can't represent, we get them to collect fees. And public guardian clients, it's not a financial hardship. This would allow us to collect fees, again, where there's not a financial hardship. I would imagine in most cases we wouldn't be collecting fees. A lot of these fraud cases are check, credit card use, you have fraudulent misappropriation of property, they only promise I'll do this and this, or just signing this, you know, quick claim deed. It's amazing the number of cases we are seeing. We currently are the public guardians of about 900 people. At least 10 to 15% that come in our door have been, you know, significantly financially exploited. Where we can, we go after. We go to small claims court. If we can, a lot of these cases can be handled in small claims court. Something more complicated, the one Mr. McDowell is going to explain, where we're looking at millions of dollars of the property. And you would think, given the assets that he lost, a private attorney to come in and take the case. However, this person cleaned him out. We don't have any ability to go in and hire a private counsel. We shopped this case to a number of firms. I got some plaintiff's attorneys to bite, but they said they couldn't do it unless they could associate themselves with a property and contract attorney because of the complexity of the case, and they couldn't find anyone to do it. I finally was able to make an arrangement with someone, and if we make a recovery, we'll retain him on his hourly wage. If not, he's agreed to eat it. So I was very lucky to find an attorney willing to take that on. But this is a growing problem in Alaska. Right now, we don't have anybody willing to step up to the plate and sue on their behalf. So again, we commend the sponsor and the co-sponsors. I think this is a necessary legislation. I'm happy to address the fiscal note if anyone has questions on that. I will say the fiscal note is conservative. I've called a number of national organizations, state attorney general's offices, tried to find out if there was a national standard on how many cases an attorney could handle in a given year of financial exploitation. Like, there are standards on how many guardian clients you have, there are standards on how many felonies a criminal attorney can handle. There are no national standards on financial exploitation cases, but from the best information I was able to put together, it looks like an attorney could handle about 65 cases a year. That 3 to 5 complex cases and the rest small claims type cases. So this lowballs. I mean, I'm asking for 3 attorneys. That's about 190 cases. We anticipate in 2005 we would have been referred 280 cases. But I'm starting too low because we need to get a year under our belt. This is an act and see what kind of capacity the attorneys have and what kind of work we're looking at. And then I will plan on coming back to the legislature and talking to you about that. With that, I'm available for any questions, Mr. Chairman.
I appreciate that, Mr. Pink. And Mr. Pink, we do have some concerns about the fiscal note, and I just spoke to the co-chairman, Schnellt, and he wants to work with Representative Hawker and yourself and try to work on this this fiscal note a little bit more. So we'll hold the bill over so there's an opportunity for that to happen.
We can go ahead. We'll go ahead with the discussion and amendments and public testimony. So that way, if there are amendments that also affect the fiscal note, we need to know what that's going to cost too. President Holt, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fink, a couple of things. Am I correct that we may be creating an unintended consequence by having you collect fees from the perpetrator who has, in essence, have taken the money that the perpetrator has from the people that have been extorted? If you follow what I'm saying, if I take money from you, put it in my pocket, and then you defend the people I stole it from, some of the state over here, then you're going to take my money and give it back to the state instead of back to the people that had the extortion. It's just a something that crossed my mind that there may be a possibility I might have an unintended consequence here. The second thing, I noticed there was no fiscal note from the public defender's office. If in fact somebody did cause or take away a smaller amount of money from somebody and was indigent, are we possibly having a fiscal note that's going to come from the a PDA that's going to affect their work? Any thoughts?
I do, through the chairman, representing the first issue, I'll go in reverse. I'll start with the public defender question. I don't anticipate you'll see a fiscal note. I spoke with Bob Newton, the district attorney in Anchorage, about how many fraudulent financial exploitation cases he prosecuted in 2005. His answer was zero. They have four, in Anchorage, they have four police officers, full time fraud unit. They've got three DAs in the property unit. And he basically said they're fairly complex cases, often they're involving small amounts of money. And he just said, we don't really prosecute them. So, you know, I can't imagine. I mean, this isn't creating any new crimes. So I can't imagine it's a minimum. This doesn't create any new crimes at all. This just allows us civilly to go after a recovery. So I don't think you'd see it just from the public defender. And it's just a matter of course right now, you don't see these cases getting prosecuted.
Mm-hmm.
In answer to your first question with regard to unintended consequences, in the legislation, there's an amendment as well, on page 3, line 27 and 28, it specifically talks about taking into consideration the financial condition of the parties. It would not be my agency's intention, and I'm sure it's not the sponsor's intention, that you would ask to recover fees from anyone and it would cause a financial hardship to. I imagine the majority of cases, we would not collect any fees, the smaller cases. An analogy could be with my public guardian clients. I'm not sure what percent, but I'm going to guess about a third of them we don't collect fees from because their income is so small, it would, and our fees aren't $40 a month for public guardian clients. But when someone's only got $80 disposable income after we pay for the residential housing and medical, we're not going to collect the fee because it causes a hardship. This does have the This requires a look at the financial condition of the parties. We develop something in regulations. The amendment contemplates an agreement going to the court for their permission. So it's not the sponsor's intention, I believe. It wouldn't be my agency's intent to collect if it caused financial hardship. I just want that in there, for instance, in the case when Mr. McDowell may address, where we're looking at someone who was defrauded of potentially $3 million of property. If we invest a lot of resources in recovering that for them, that's a significant potential recovery, and I wouldn't want the agency to eat that. So I have a mechanism in place to where we could get our actual cost. But I don't envision the recovery cost from the majority of the clients.
Thank you.
Thank you. President Kelly?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, like you, have a real problem with the fiscal note here, and the new and kinder and gentler AARP sometimes I think would have us believe too often that everyone that is in the category of over 60 is vulnerable, sick, poor, and unable to think for themselves. And I think that that is largely not the case, particularly as people are living longer and medical care is better. And I'm afraid, I don't trust our ability to carry out this thing regarding fiscal, regarding the hardship. This is not anything against what you said. But I'm very concerned that this is an area that we're switching from the criminal to the civil. That's the guts and the heart of this this action, as I understand it. Otherwise, I would say, go do your work. You already have the power to do it. But I am very, very concerned that we are in a state where the cost of our health is going for the moon, seems uncontrollable. We're entering one more phase here where if we try to get the fiscal note now, we may be fooling ourselves because you're going to get frequent flyers, people that think they've been abused that haven't, or because it's nearly free, you're going to get people that want to test every little credit card problem they had or whatever, which I would tell them is their problem if they're sound of mind. And so I Mr. Chairman, I have a problem with this thing. I think it's the door that opens, that looks like it's a nice thing to do, and it may not be. I think it may open up something here that we didn't intend. So if we are to pass this, I would want to see the hurdle high and the gatekeeper tough. Because if we don't, this thing is going to look a lot different 5 years from now than it looks today as we gently ease into this thing. Because I can imagine the number of frequent flyers you're going to have on this over every little hassle they've had is going to overwhelm the three attorneys. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Comment, Mr. Kelly?
Mr.
Vick.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelly, and I share the concern. One thing I would not want to do is set up unrealistic expectations and find the office overwhelmed. What I would envision, and in speaking with the sponsor, staff, and Adult Protective Services, is Adult Protective Services currently has five investigators. That investigates complaints about vulnerable adults. They investigated about 1,800 in 2005. Of that 1,800, 500 were the financial exploitation cases. There are some sidebars that have been put on this. This bill requires maybe over 60. That takes your 500 and drops it to about 65% of that 500 was over 60. And you have 90% of them were verified. So that takes us to about 280. My thoughts would be that we would have an agreement. This bill requires me to enter these cooperative agreements that Adult Protective Services would be the gatekeeper, and they would make referrals to us. We would not take referrals directly. They would come through Adult Protective Services after they screen them. The committee may want to put on additional sidebars, but I understand your answer.
Yeah, and I did just follow up. Mm-hmm. When you've got the private attorney who's working for a buck, that person can tell the frequent flyer, not taking it, out of here. Not a good complaint. Not going to work. Not worth chasing. I don't think that a state employee has that same ability to say, we're not going to meet with you every Wednesday for 2 hours to talk about your case. And I'm just speaking as a legislator who has frequent flyers, and some of them don't have any legitimate gripe at all, and yet they still take our time beyond belief at times. So anyway, not challenging what you said. I understand clearly where you're coming from. It's just I have a real worry that this will look like a nightmare, not a dream, in 5 years.
I understand your concerns, Mr. Daly. For the record, President Weirich has been with this for some time. President Hawker, you have a question?
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Likewise, I'd just like to sort of pile on one of the points and just something I'd like to see us flesh out as we go forward with this. And that's defining this data point of the magic 60 years of age or older is somehow determinant of someone who merits this state-sponsored, state-sanctioned legal service, and someone who is 59 years old doesn't. I'm just a little concerned about trying to define the impossible here. And I don't have a ready answer. It's more of a rhetorical comment on my part. How do we come up all of a sudden that 60 is the is the magic break over here? 65, 72, what about individuals in this whole concept they're presenting here? What about an individual of diminished capacity who and without not be able to bring a complaint without assistance, who may be 40 years old? We're trying to carve out a whole new social services agency on good and meritorious mission, but if we define it too narrowly, are we creating a special interest legislation group? But if we create it too broadly, this will be $1 billion expenditure. I'll get another PCA. It'll be $100 million a year expenditure in 7 years. So I guess can you help me get a grip on what we're really trying to carve out here?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, it's a policy question on where you want to make that cutoff. I know that Adult Protective Services suggested that rather than the age of 60, you use vulnerable adult, and that's defined in statute as a person 8 years of age or older who, because of physical or mental impairment, is unable to meet the person's own needs or to seek help without assistance. That definition is currently in statute. I know they proposed that. Again, it's where do you want the sidebars? Beyond that, the sponsor's office is age 60. I can't comment on that. Any of your thoughts?
Yes, ma'am.
Truth Chair, Representative Hawker. We looked at many other statutes, and 60 years old was in quite a few of the regulations. We discussed vulnerable adults. However, vulnerable adults, I believe, is in the 18 and older. actually, I don't want to give you that information just in case it's wrong. I want to double check if I can come back to you and answer.
Always happy to allow the latitude.
Through the chair, just to add to that, the difference in numbers, if we look at the reports to Adult Protective Services, they have 500 reports of the financial exploitation. 65% of that group was 60 or older. So if you use the definition of vulnerable adult, you'd be looking at an additional 500 versus the 280.
And I guess my question being, what makes those persons being excluded any less vulnerable, any less meritorious of the goodwill being extended by the hand of government here than those over 60?
Through the chair, Representative Hoffer, that is simply, I think, a sidebar that was put out to try to limit the scope of the service, and I can't really answer that question.
Yeah. The appropriate answer is that would be our choice. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Representative Hoffer. Any other questions for the sponsor? Okay, seeing none at this time, if you want to stand by, let's go ahead and take up public testimony, and then we'll take amendments, and then we'll, like I said, then we'll set this aside for today and give you guys a chance to talk. Okay, so to testify, looks like we have Dan McDowell. Is he online? Okay. Mr. McDowell?
Yes.
Go ahead, sir.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank all of you for this opportunity, the chair, especially Representative Chenault and his staff. Without Sue Wright, we would have never made any progress on this case. And when we finally met Josh Fink, he's worked wonders. He's went far beyond the call of duty trying to help our family. In saying that, I'd like to tell you folks that I'm a lifetime Alaskan. I was born in the territory of Alaska. My father came up to Alaska shortly after World War II, and he started several businesses that he was a very successful businessman. But unfortunately, about 7 years ago now, he contracted Alzheimer's and dementia. My mom came up here and lived in Seward when she was 18, and so they've been here, they're long-time Alaskans. They've been here most of their working life. And when Dad contracted Alzheimer's and dementia, Mom had been a housewife, mostly living in Anchorage, and she had done the finances. After Dad got sick, she had to take on the whole estate, and that's where this relative of ours from Colorado got involved. And my mother is very religious. She's a born-again Christian, and this guy played the religious card. He told us as a family that he was going to put our properties in a trust. He had my mother sell her home in Anchorage for about $200,000. That money was supposed to go into the trust, into an LLC called Genesis, and he was going to draw from that to help my mother live, which never happened. He, over the course of several months, had my mother sign over papers, which she thought the properties were going to go into the trust, the LLC, and she signed quitclaim deeds. And he, over the course of several months, had her give him all of our family property. Their dad had an interest in an island in Soldovia. He has Homer property. He's got 5 acres in Mama Bear Lake up in Talkeetna. He has 5 acres on the Gulcana River right beside the beautiful new wheelchair accessible campground. And on and on. He also has a piece of property, which is his first love on the Kenai River, 1,150 feet in Sterling, where I operate my guide business. I run a wheelchair accessible guide service where I cater to disabled veterans. I'm gearing up this summer for the first National Veterans Wheelchair Games. And now we have no place to operate. This relative of ours has given my parents an eviction notice. He's tied up all of their money. He's leased properties on their behalf and then made a side deal with the builder that he was to get the $4,000 a month. So he's literally taken every dime my parents have and their property, so to the point that they can't defend themselves. So this bill, House Bill 399, which I firmly believe that it's needed. This bill and other bills to protect our seniors, this isn't an economic issue as far as your social status. This can happen to anybody. this guy took a multimillionaire. My father spent his entire life trying to help people. Thousands of dollars he's taken and hundreds of acres. And my father spent his entire life trying to, he was a public advocate. He was instrumental in buying, in some cases, using his own money and turning property over to the state because he believed in public access. And his legacy was going to be our totally barrier-free wheelchair-accessible lodge on McKenai. I run the only guide service with the even electric wheelchairs can go on my boat. So just to keep this brief, guys, we need this bill or something similar to protect, because each one of us in our golden years, we can be fleeced by these smooth-talking fellas that are either it's religion or something else. And he turned my parents against our family. They didn't ask us what was going on. She just signed every document that he put before her and systematically took everything they owned, so they can't defend themselves. I would like to say on behalf of our family that, but if you folks help us and help other seniors, you've got my word, we will pay you back. This is nothing, we don't want anything for nothing. We have every intention of paying the state of Alaska back, but my father and mother have lost everything they own. And I believe Josh Fink, he was the only one. I went to Senator Stevens' office, and they were very helpful. Jim Egan in Senator Stevens' office looked at this, was very concerned. We forwarded this information on to the FBI, and they were very concerned, but they thought it was a civil case, when in fact it is, but it's also a criminal case of fraud. And regardless of your age, 60, I heard you comment on the age for this bill, but there are a lot of vulnerable Alaskans, young children that might acquire their family's estate, and you've got people out there that are constantly trying to con us as Alaskans, lifetime Alaskans. I'd like to see a bill that protects Alaskans, and I just really appreciate this time, and I'd be happy to answer your questions. Thank you.
Hey, Mr. McDowell, thank you very much for your testimony. Don't see any questions, but again, thank you for joining us this morning and giving us your testimony.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Okay. Mr. Sniffen, I have you online here, but are you for questions or did you want to testify, sir?
He's off the hall testifying in another hearing right now. He'll probably be free in about 3 or 4 minutes.
Okay. We can check back in 3 or 4 minutes, and we'll go ahead and see if there's anyone here in Juneau to testify. Don't see anyone, so let's go ahead and do Representative Hawker.
Mr. Chairman, would it be out of order to ask if I could ask a couple more questions to Mr. Fink?
No, that would be appropriate, Mr. Fink. And for the record, Representative Foster has joined us. Mr. Fink.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This concept, sort of a big picture question again. We're creating an Office of Elder Fraud. And again, we've seen some of these, it's all about fraud, which are all currently criminal. I believe, is it not the intent that this is providing a way to go after someone who is, we believe, has committed a criminal activity?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, that would be a subset, but that's not the entire group of people. You can have fraud occur that's not criminal. For it to be criminal, you'd have to prove elements beyond reasonable doubt and intentional elements. In the civil context, it's a preponderance. So you've got lots of cases that may not rise to the level of criminality, but yet you've got civil fraud.
So we do have, it's both criminal as well as civil.
Correct.
To the level that is criminal, is that in your fiscal note, is that contemplated here, or it seems to me that's a providence of the Department of Law. Currently, if we've got a case of potentially fraud prosecutable to a criminal standard, do we not already have existent resources that ought be pursuing that issue?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, it would be my hope that if this some office were set up, there would be an agreement with law and the police where we make referrals so that we can prosecute those cases. For the cases that are criminal, you can get restitution in a criminal case, so you wouldn't need a civil suit. The problem is we don't have to be pursued by law enforcement agencies. And I've talked to the district attorney, I've talked to people at Adult Protective Services. They make regular referrals to the DAs and the police. The cases are not being prosecuted.
And then follow-up question in a different vein, but another question. Section 2, the sort of last provision on page 3 of the bill, which is the cost recovery if the Office of Public Advocacy is found to be the prevailing party after trial or settlement. As it is written, does this allow you to recover from both the dependent both the defendant if they have assets and the victim if the victim has assets?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, and there is an amendment on this section, but as written, it potentially could. The problem with this writing this section is that we've got three court rules that provide for recovery of attorney's fees in civil matters. And I don't think it was the sponsor's intent. I would not suggest we tinker with those court rules. So we were trying to craft something that would allow us to recover our actual costs. No, this would be a contingency fee when we're making a profit. Our actual costs that will be actually pay our hourly attorneys for. If the recovery was such that they could afford to pay us back without financial hardship. Whether this language gets us there or not, I'll leave that to the committee and the legal drafting. That's what we're attempting. But it's not tinkering with the current court rules. I mean, in the context of a civil case, if you were prevailing, you would use the three court rules. You know, it depends when you make an offer of settlement and if they accept and what percentage of fees you get, that's part of the judgment. That would be to the party prevail. So if you were representing someone and they prevailed and they got fees from the court, that would then go to their kitty. This would allow us to say, now, we got this recovery for you, and it would not be a financial hardship for you to give us back X percent of our costs. So we would like to recover those costs and put it back in the state treasury for the services we provide.
Thank you for that comment at the moment, because I just reserve further judgment. Sure. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Very good. Thank you, Representative Hawker.
Representative Holt.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fink, kind of to follow up on what Representative Hawker said, does this case, the McDonald case that we were talking about, does that rise to a criminal level? Is that a criminal case, in your opinion?
Through the chair, Representative Holt, I'm not a prosecutor. In looking at it, it appears to me that it is fraudulent, it is criminal fraud, but they've not been able to get the FBI to bite, and the state hasn't been in the process of pursuing a remedy for the McDowells. As we collect evidence, we will, if we believe we've got enough new evidence to forward the prosecuting authorities, we will do so and try to interest them in criminal prosecution.
Mr. Chairman, if I could follow up. Well, I guess I'm wrestling, I think, with Representative Kelly's idea as well, that, you know, civil cases are remedy, as far as I know, the tort remedy is a remedy between individuals that don't rise to criminal cases. When we say it's a case that is against all of society, then we have a statute, we have a criminal remedy. And I'm nervous, considering that we do policy, which says, and this does to me, that we don't have personal responsibility for our dealings with each other, that somehow the government is going to say that it's okay for you to make bad mistakes, and yet we're going to cover for you, regardless of your age or your competency. How do we know that people don't freely enter into these agreements, or how do you know how people don't freely enter into those agreements with a full understanding of what the issue is and change their minds?
Through the chair, Representative Holm, well, these are things you have to vet. I mean, my assumption would be Adult Protective Services, when I look at these cases, If it's simply buyer's remorse, that's not a case of financial exploitation. In McDowell's case, we had Mr. McDowell suffering from Alzheimer's. He was not fully mentally present. And this individual was bringing documents to his wife to sign, who had never been involved in the business side ever. And he said, "We'll take care of you, and we'll take care of the finances. Just sign the dotted line," and she did it. That to me is different than buyer's remorse.
But doesn't that, you know, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, but doesn't that rise to criminal fraud? I mean, if I understand what fraud is, I think I understand what fraud is. Is that not fraud, and should that be classified as something that is statutorily wrong in the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, I think it's criminal fraud. Again, I know the Representative Schultz's office voted it by, I believe, local and or state, and then the feds. It's difficult to prove, fraud is a specific intent crime, and it's difficult to prove criminal. With this idea that either something's in the criminal realm or civil realm, though, I think that's a misunderstanding. There is analogies in tort to everything in criminal. For instance, if someone burns down your house, that's arson. It's also converted to tort of conversion. If you look at O.J. Simpson, another example, he was acquitted criminally, but he was found civilly to kill his wife. So you've got the analogy in civil law to most things you have in criminal law. It's the burden of proof is going to be different. And you will often have a set of facts or circumstances that definitely have sensed something wrong occurred here, but if there's not enough there to prosecute a criminal, that doesn't mean he can't pursue it civilly.
Anything else?
No, for the okay, that's fine.
Peter St. Kelly, you had a question?
Just how many states have one of these on the books?
Through the chair, Representative Kelly. I wasn't able, I did contact all 50 states. I contacted the national organizations and states we've worked with previously. Cook County in Illinois was one, and they have 100 attorneys in their fraud recovery unit. They have combined civil and criminal authority. So they prosecute and then recover civilly, and when they can't prosecute, they still recover civilly. But I wasn't able to find anything that's exactly this. It doesn't exist in the contract of the states. It was more mixtures of functions, and this was part of their function among others, the state side.
Thank you. Just follow.
Sure, go ahead.
Is it possible, this might be more palatable, if what we said was, so we kept our judgment fine-tuned, that we're not going to, we are going to take a third of the recovery. Doesn't matter, you were worse off before the state came in to try to help you. We take a third of whatever's recovered. Is there any, there's no element of that in there that I agree with. Is there?
Through the chair, Representative Kelly, currently there's not, and that could be a very legitimate way to go. That's just a policy call.
Thank you.
Representative Kelly. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Fink. Again, for the time being, if you could just have a seat there. Let's go ahead and take up the two amendments that we know about, and then we'll come back and see if okay, looks like Mr. Sniffen is back online. Mr. Sniffen, it was unclear if you wanted to testify or if you were just available for questions.
Through the chair, thank you very much for your patience. My name is Ed Sniffen, and I'm an assistant attorney general with the Department of Law, and I am responsible for enforcing Alaska's consumer protection and antitrust statute. And I wanted to testify briefly with your commission on some of the unintended or potential unintended consequences of this bill.
Okay, go ahead, sir.
Yes, thank you. First, let me say that the department certainly supports any efforts we can take to help protect the elderly. And under our Consumer Protection Act, the Department of Law does have the authority and jurisdiction to pursue cases of fraud against the elderly, and we do so on a daily basis. Our resources, unfortunately, are limited, as with many state agencies, and it's impossible for us to act as everyone's individual lawyer. So we focus our efforts on fraud that has a significant impact on the greater public interest. Our statute, though, contains a provision that prevents us from exercising jurisdiction over cases that are properly regulated by another agency or another division. So I wanted to make clear that if this legislation goes forward, that there be some provision in the bill that does not exempt our office from going forward with pursuing and prosecuting, you know, fraud. Then I have to apologize. I don't have the recent version of the bill. I'm working off a backslash A version, so perhaps some of the amendments include that provision. I just wanted to throw it out there to make sure that there's some provision that provides, no matter what the Office of Public Advocacy wants to do, that we still have the authority to proceed with investigations of fraud that involve the elderly. And one other comment I'll make, and I can perhaps speak to this in more detail if this comes back to the hearing, because I haven't looked at it in any depth, but some of the members of the committee hit around this issue, and that is, you know, we drew this line at 60 years of age, and there's an equal protection concern here that I'm not sure I have an answer to, and that is why the 59-year-old person who is the victim of some financial fraud is being denied this wealth of state services when the 60-year-old is. And, you know, age discrimination in that regard is something the Constitution forbids unless there's a very good reason for it. I could see it if there were a line drawn for vulnerable adults who don't have the means to protect themselves, but let's say you have a 60-year-old elderly person with a tremendous amount of resources, and you have a 59-year-old elderly person with no resources. The 60-year-old would receive the benefit of this legislation, but the 59-year-old would not, and for no other reason than we just happen to draw the line there. And I'm not sure constitutionally that would be allowed, but I will see if I can find an answer to that for you for the next committee. But anyway, with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have of the department, and thank you for your patience and allowing me to testify.
Okay, well, thank you for joining us this morning, Mr. Sniffen. Any questions? Representative Schnell has questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sniffen, what would stop the Department of Law from, as an example, looking into the McDowell case and bringing charges against the people involved there?
Through the chair, if we were aware of that case, we would look at the issues, and we would have to analyze the case to decide if we had the resources to pursue it. And I wasn't here. I was actually across the hall testifying on another bill when that case, I think, was explained. And I understand it involves some exploitation involving a gentleman with Alzheimer's. But if it is something that is very unique and particular to an individual, it's something that we're not likely to become too interested in unless we can identify a pattern or practice of unfair behavior that affects a significant number of Alaskans. We have a very small office. There's myself and two other attorneys, one of whom is only part-time, that do all the consumer protection for the entire state of Alaska. So we're restricted, unfortunately, to focusing our efforts on broader scope kinds of issues. And so if there was, for example, a real estate agent in town who was systematically defrauding elderly clients in real estate transactions, and we had, you know, 10 or 15 identified victims, that's something we would be very interested in, and we would try and address that issue. If it is an individual with a very specific problem unique to that individual, that's something that's more appropriate for an individual attorney to handle. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, yeah, somewhat. You know, I guess I have my concerns that we have a department out there that doesn't look at all cases. And I realize that you're limited because of funding of how far that you can go. But in this specific case, the McDowells, that's their life. No different than if it's any other. Whether it's 10 or 15 in my book, whether it's 10 or 15 different seniors or others that are affected by a scam artist or something. I understand that, but there's got to be a way that we look at individual cases and bring merit to those cases. This is one we know about. I don't know how many more there might be after. You know, I don't know if this is the first case that this particular guy's done, if it's only dealing with this particular family or if there's other cases out there. And, you know, they need the ability to be able to talk with someone and try to find out, you know, if they can get their case taken care of. And I realize that you say it's the job for other attorneys, private attorneys, to take up the case, but you yourself know, as Mr. Fink stated earlier, that you can talk to a lot of attorneys, and if there's not money there to pay the case, they're not going to take that case up. So with that, Mr. Chairman, that's probably more of a statement than a question.
Okay.
Mr. Sutton, and I do appreciate your comments.
I think, Mr. Sniffen, did I hear you trying to get back on?
Yes, through the chair, I just, those are very good comments, and there's no question that we are sensitive to those, and I wish we did have the resources to pursue more cases on behalf of individual consumers. There are literally, you know, thousands of people who have their lives destroyed, you know, annually in this state because they just don't have the money to afford a lawyer. And we need to ask ourselves, do we want to become another, you know, legal services agency? Do we want to represent all of those individuals who have these problems and become their private lawyers? And it is a funding issue more than anything. And I know that doesn't detract from the seriousness of all these cases, like Mr. McDowell's, and that is a terrible, terrible case. There are many, many, many more out there like that. And it is it's a policy call and a resource call, and it is unfortunate.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Sniffen. Seeing no other questions, thank you again for your testimony and for joining us this morning. Okay, is there anyone else who wants to testify? Seeing no one here, no one online. Okay, the public testimony is closed. Let's go ahead and go to amendments. We have two that I know of. And like I said, we'll do the amendments, and then we'll turn this bill back over to the sponsor to work with both Mr. Fink and Representative Hocker to deal with some of the fiscal issues involved here. So, Ms. Cunningham?
Mr. Chair, I believe Representative Kelly also expressed interest.
Okay. You got that, Mr. Representative Schultz? Representative Kelly also has interest in joining you. Okay. Okay.
More the merrier.
Jump on. All right. First amendment we have is a consent amendment number one, and I'll move it.
Object.
Okay, it's been moved and objected to. Ms. Cunningham, my staff will explain the amendment. Ms. Cunningham?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Suzanne Cunningham, staff to represent Kamina. One correction on conceptual amendment number one. It is written to the /G version, and it should be to the F version. So the page reference is page 4, lines 5 through 6. That's what it says.
Okay, so that's, that's an amendment to the amendment. Is there any objections to that technical change? See that. Go ahead. Ms. Cunningham.
On page 4, lines 5 through 6, actually that section begins that fraud means robbery, extortion, and coercion under AS 1141-500 through 1141-530. So it's specific to those three. Subsection B then says theft and related offenses under AS 1146-100 through 1146-740. In reviewing those statutes, it's a very broad reference. There's definitely theft in the first through the fourth degree, unlawful possession, issuing a bad check, fraudulent use of an access device, which would be a credit card or a PIN number for an ATM card. But then there's also disregard of highway obstruction, unlawful possession of office traffic control devices, criminal mischief in the first degree, which involves shooting or destroying a pipeline or a public utility. And in a traditional sense, those may not be associated with fraud. So in talking with our legal services drafter, Jean Michelle, we did think it was appropriate to limit it to those crimes that specifically address the potential to fraud or deceive someone.
Question, Representative Katuba.
Thanks very much. Yeah, I could see that you were trying to limit it down, and I was trying to figure out exactly which one of the ones you've dropped. And I'm not positive, but it looks to me like you might have dropped some of them that arguably should still be within the ambit. You've got, looks to me like maybe defrauding creditors is out, one of the forgeries might be out, and one of the, something called criminal simulation, which I don't know, but I could conceivably think of somebody faking a document. So I think maybe this might be one we might want to take a real good look at and decide which really we want in the fraud or not. I mean, it does. I think probably the list is okay, but I'm just not sure with some of them. The ones that you mentioned sure should come out, I mean, the pipeline, et cetera, but some of these frauds, I'm not sure. You might want them in just to be sure you got the specific situation.
Through the chair, Representative Kurtzula, just looking at this briefly, criminal simulation is not listed there. It should be. And also defrauding creditors. Those were two that were not listed that definitely have potential to defraud someone, yes.
Okay. Maybe the best thing to do is hold off on the amendments, and then when the sponsor comes back with the bill, we can take the amendments at that time. And that'll give you some time, Ms. Cunningham, to do some further research on Amendment 1. So I'd like to withdraw Amendment 1 for the time being. Is there any objections to that? Okay. Then let's, Amendment 1 has been withdrawn, so we can have a little more time to research that. Representative Kelly?
Is the gentleman from the AG's office, for the name that begins with S, that I didn't quite get?
Is he still with us? Mr. Smith, are you still with us?
No, he escaped.
Yeah. Well, we can get him back, though, when the bill comes
back. Two points come to mind. One, we kept talking about funding, which we're used to here. But if he had half of the fiscal note, could he take care of these 290 estimated cases, would be one question. And the second, not offering it, that money, but would that make a difference in that? And the other thing was that there was a this gentleman referred to, Mr. Fink referred to, states where the criminal arm is empowered, where there's a fraud situation, to cross the line over into the civil area, is the way I read what you said. And I'm just wondering if with the sponsor's indulgence, if there's a way to do this that would address some of the heavy concerns around the table that I think are pretty legitimate. I always think mine are legitimate, but I think sometimes it when there are several concerns that maybe we're on to something. Anyway, those are a couple of points that if they had the money, could they do it better? And if they were empowered where they think it's fraud, to say, well, it's fraud, but it's a little edgy, a little bit dicey for us, let's go civil on this one. And then the third thing would be to put in the recovery, so the state's number one, right up there. If we're going to go help somebody, the state's number one at the trough when you collect some money for a third of it or something like that. I see an entitlement here that scares the hell out of me.
Sure, understand. Good points, Representative Kelly. And I think not officially. Okay, Mr. Smith is back. I think let's hold off, Representative Kelly. I think having you and Representative Hawker and sponsor together with Mr. Fink, I think a lot of the concerns and issues you brought up will be flushed out, and then we'll bring this back to the before the Finance Committee. Mr. Fink, you're in Anchorage, is that correct?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, we'll certainly try to give you adequate notice, so either you can join us online or if you can come back. That's great to do. Okay, so for now, let's set this bill aside.
May I make a suggestion?
Yes, Rex, there are.
Page 4 of the bill, line 8, there's a word significant. I think we should get rid of significant. I think if there's any benefit to the crew, to a person who takes advantage of someone, which that they should be subject to this. So then we don't dance around what significant is or isn't. So just as observation for the group working on this.
Very good. Thank you, Rex. Okay. Any other comments on this bill before we set it aside? Seeing none? And we'll put that aside for the time being and go on to the majority leader.
House Bill 400. Let's see, before we get started here, we do have a CS.
I move that we adopt blank committee substitute for House Bill 40, version 24, LS1543, / L. Buckup, March 1st, 2006. The working document for consideration of the future.
Okay, any objections to that CS before us? Say none. We do have the sponsor here with us today. Good to see you, Mr. Majority Leader. I think this is your first time this year.
It is.
All right, well, welcome.
Thanks for hearing the bill.
For the record, if you tell us your name and your affiliation and explain the bill to us.
Yes, my name is John Foggio. I'm a representative from District 11, North Portland. And this is, I've been before this committee very few times, so I'm nervous from the legs down.
This will be his cheapest visit, I think.
Chairman, thank you for having CS House Bill 400, and thanks for helping the working draft. And I expect to see some amendments, which I will mention earlier. This bill came out of discussion at one of the natural disasters we had in America, the hurricanes that hit the Gulf Coast. And started a discussion up in the interior with many of us on during those disasters, if law-abiding citizens had their arms confiscated, would we up there agree with that type of action? The answer is no, and I don't think that would ever be the state's policy anyway, given such the strong language in our Constitution. But I thought best to go ahead and put it in the policy under the section of law that we have under disasters, under the Alaska Disaster Act, under the list of things that people would be limited in doing during a natural disaster. So the policy call is section one, the limitation is nothing in this disaster act authorizes the confiscation of lawfully owned, possessed, or carried firearms by law-abiding citizens. During disasters, obviously people can act badly, and that can be true of government officials as well as non-government officials. And bad actors should be held accountable. And anybody who misuses a firearm, in my view, needs to be held to the fullest extent of the law. And any government official who equally acts badly, steps over their line of authority, should be held accountable for that. So the first thing is the policy call, and then in section two is my attempt to craft a solution to what do we do when somebody who is an official acting in a public trust capacity crosses the line. I started off by thinking in terms of felony. I've wandered into this arena talking about forfeiture office and the position, say like a police officer, stand before a police council and having their certification revoked. I've been made privy to the public amendments that may come for this committee, and one of them is a technical change in section one, which is just a good language change. And the other one, I'm very open to. We ended up in a civil capacity, so criminal capacity is this thing has moved through, and I'm open to discussion on it. But the policy call that I really want to make is the section one accountability is how do we do it, how do we hold people accountable. I think once the policy call is made, all confidence in the public officials who have public trust in Alaska that they would follow that policy call. And this is for that very occasion where some of my voters have about. So, Mr. Chairman, I set a bill for you. I'll be prepared to answer questions. I do have something for testimony, I think.
Yes, we do have Brian Judy.
NRA.
And I have Mr. Dean Bonelli here to help in some of the finer points of the law if we need that help.
Okay, very good. I'm just noticing it's a zero fiscal note.
As I understand it, yes.
We're always happy to see you here, Mr. Majority Leader. But
I think it's clear from the committee, Mr. Chairman, that the speakers have to give two to committees of referrals.
Very good. We're happy to hear this.
I will accept the wisdom of this committee.
A few better for this issue.
One good thing, Mr. Majority Leader, is that by the time it gets to the floor, you know, at least 11 members on finance. Okay. Is there any questions for the sponsor?
Representative Schell? I'll start with the first one. A person forfeits any office of governmental position by statute. Can you do that to an elected official, to a mayor, for instance, of a city or of a borough?
That might be my intention. And at this point, it's left up to civil action. If a person was in a challenge that particular official, it would right now be a civil action. And there will be an amendment that I think will make it a criminal action. That, remember that, and I'll have to ask Mr. Guarnelli to help on this, but it seems to me that changed the level of culpability of the standard of proof. But that's what I started at originally, so but right now it'd be a civil action.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other questions for the sponsor? Okay. Well, then right now, this is okay, but we may have more as we go along, and we'll take up the amendments.
Mr. Chairman, I have to leave at 10:30, so I may end up leaving my staff in charge of it. So, and then Mr. Chairman, here.
Mr. Calcula, have you seen the amendments?
And I have.
You okay?
And I'm going to concur with both of them, yes.
Okay. Well, that'll help. Okay. Very good. Thank you, Mr. Calcula. Let's go ahead and go take testimony. And I do have on my list here Mr. Judy with the NRA Alaska. Mr. Judy, you with us?
I am. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, to the committee. Thank you for the time this morning. On behalf of the Alaska members of the National Rifle Association, I want to urge your support for House Bill 400. Recent events in the New Orleans area during the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina demonstrate that the right to keep our arms is especially important during a state of emergency. The very basis of the Second Amendment is the empowerment of individuals with the right to self-protection. And when is self-protection more critical than during a time of disaster when law enforcement resources are stretched beyond their limits? House Bill 400 would protect law-abiding Alaska citizens from experiencing the blatant violation of their constitutional rights that occurred in New Orleans in the wake of the hurricane, when law-abiding citizens were stripped of their firearms by a few overzealous government officials. In fact, NRA was forced to file a lawsuit to stop this egregious violation of the rights of people who were only trying to protect their families and property. In fact, that litigation is still ongoing. Just in the last week or so, things have been happening on that. This bill would simply clarify that during any state of disaster or emergency, lawfully owned, possessor-carried firearms cannot be seized from law-abiding citizens. And this bill would also make accountable, as the sponsor indicated, for his or her action, any person who knowingly confiscates a lawfully possessed firearm from a law-abiding citizen. So I just want to urge you to help ensure that what happened in New Orleans will never happen in Alaska, and urge your support for this bill.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Judy, any questions? Committee members? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Okay, is there anyone here in Juneau who wanted to testify? Seeing none, anyone online? Okay, so we'll go ahead and close public testimony and go right into amendments this time. Representative Hawker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move amendment number one, sir.
Okay, I'll object. Here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Amendment number one is, this is the amendment, and I guess perhaps even, I want my mother's amendment. My mother was a high school English teacher. This is grammar. We have, as it currently reads, we've got a prepositional phrase in the middle of line four of a lawfully in possession firearm. If you take, you know, discounting, take the prepositional phrase out of the context, All we're doing is authorizing the confiscation by law-abiding citizens. Grammatically, all this amendment does is grammatically change the language to accomplish identically the same thing, but as you can see by the little box on the amendment for reference, it would now say that authorizes the confiscation of a firearm, firearm being the object of a prepositional phrase, a firearm lawfully owned, possessed, or carried by a law-abiding citizen. Again, it's just better grammar, sir.
Sure. Okay. Sounds good. I'll remember my objection. Any other objection? Seeing none, Amendment 1 passes.
Mr. Chairman, I move Amendment Number 2 and would move it with the understanding that it is conceptual only to the great degree that it might be needed to be adjusted ever so slightly to conform to a legislative drafting or whatever might be encountered in slipping this into the bill.
Okay, I'll object. Go ahead, and Mr. Hopper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 1 of this bill says that, you know, we shall not take firearms away from law-abiding citizens, or no one shall authorize the confiscation of a firearm from a law-abiding citizen, period. In the context of our overall statutes, it's during the, you know, this whole thing about, you know, in a dealing with an emergency or disaster sort of thing. We have the shall not established in Section 1. Section 2 says, however, if somebody commits this crime, there shall be a penalty. And currently, as read, the penalty is a person forfeits. I mean, it is a person forfeits, period. Presumption of guilt, no standards, but a person forfeits any office or government position held, and then basically if you've done this terrible thing and had no reason to believe you didn't have that right to do it. Considering that the folks we'd be affecting with this would really be Alaska's law enforcement community, and I firmly stand totally 112%, maybe 13 or 14% behind the need to protect the First Amendment of the Constitution, as was testified to by Mr. Judy, we also, and the NRA also recognizes the important relation we have with our law enforcement communities in providing appropriate protections of the process of law for law enforcement members is as important to us as protecting the individual rights of law-abiding citizens. In that this section did not have any any standard or mechanism for that due process to be exercised. And so that he said, I read that as saying we were going to deny a person in law enforcement or in government, access to a court of adjudication. You know, there would be evidence provided or the ability to debate the issue. This amendment essentially inserts, if we take a look at page, it replaces the first few lines here, lines 7 through 10, of the consequences for committing this act. And it, as I talked with Mr. Guinelli, he said, well, if a person had done this, the way they'd be prosecuted would be under the statutes on official misconduct or for interfering with constitutional rights. So this now evolves that penalty provision, the consequences provision, to stating that a person forfeits any office or government position if, and the conditional here is important, if that person is convicted, and emphasis in convicted meaning that it has gone through an adjudication process of official misconduct or interference with constitutional rights as a result of confiscating, attempting to confiscate, or ordering the confiscation of a firearm. Essentially, if you've done this thing and are convicted of it, then you forfeit your office. This does two things. It also raises the bar here from simple the presumption that a civil process or an administrative process through the Police Standards Council would be sufficient to literally deprive an elected official of their title position or forever deprive a law enforcement officer of their ability to perform that job in this state. It will require meeting the burdens of proof of a criminal standard rather than just the civil administrative procedure. I think it's very important. And I have had experience enough with legislative drafting to suspect that they will not allow us to just leave these specific statutory references in the bill. They have this habit where they're wanting something a little more generic. But recognizing that, that's still, I believe, the amendment is in order appropriate and a very good thing for us to do, recognizing both the protection of constitutional rights as well as our support for Alaska's law enforcement community operating in good faith.
Okay. Very good questions. Representative Stokes.
Thank you. And I think you've set a pretty tough standard of conviction. What I've seen it from light from some of our labor relations is, do you think this is still subject to, even if they've been convicted of filing a grievance and ailments, or that's...
To the chair, Representative Stoltz, I had, you know, one of the initial questions I raised through in regarding this issue was here in the original version of the bill, the original CS we had in front of us here, it seemed to immediately forfeit anything without regard to that contractual, the sanctity of the contract and the labor, bargain labor agreement. I'll be honest with you, I don't know exactly how that will interfere today, but I believe raising this to the criminal standards is such, and it's a speculation on my part, which is always dangerous to do in a legislative setting, but you know, I've got to believe that somewhere inside the collectively bargained agreement, there's a provision that says if a cop goes bad, does, you know, commits a crime, is convicted, there are then consequences acceptable in the labor-related agreements. However, which is why I believe this amendment provides the forum then to properly address that action in determining how it might consequentially be further handled in the labor under the labor bargaining agreements, but that as just currently offered, as the CS first came forward, when it was just this automatic forfeiture, that seemed to me to be something trying to circumvent the bargain labor, or that might unintentionally circumvent the bargain labor agreement. So I have done my best hope to address the question you raised, sir.
I appreciate that attention, Mr. Chair. I always notice who's in the stands, and I see a couple of guys from there. They didn't have to testify, but they appear to be watching it. And as carefully as you've constructed this, and I know your attention to that. We'll see, I guess, down the line.
And Mr. Chair, I still am a little queasy on the issue here, but I think the time we've had a lot of this to a good solution. But again, as bills do, there's a long way for this to move through the system for that to be addressed, but I appreciate the points Representative Stoltz has made and concur 100%.
Very good. And we will want to bring up Dean Cornella too to kind of talk a little bit too about how this amendment works with the bill. And I thought Fate was just here for the coffee, so I don't know.
Yeah.
And last time he was here, he bought us donuts, so he's always welcome. In fact, if any of you see, Tim Kelly, it's been over there.
Yeah, where are the donuts?
Yeah, well, I haven't seen Tim Kelly to remind you, he owes us donuts. Yeah. Anyway, Representative Holman.
I think, Mr. Chairman, if you're all right with you, Mr. Quinnell can come up. I have a question with regards to the drafting of Amendment Number 2, and I don't know if he eventually drafted this, but my question has to do with the art form that says the color of law. I don't know. I guess it's for my own edification. I'm going to plead non-understanding of how that affects this amendment. It's called ignorance. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
For the record, my name is Dean Winnell, Chief Assistant Attorney General of the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Through the chair, Representative Holman, color of law is a term of art, if you will. It exists in federal civil rights law. It exists in at least a couple of places in Alaska statutes. And what it reflects is simply that the person who is doing this is doing it under the cover of some authority, some lawful authority that they profess to have. In essence, it's something that a government official does.
That cover, a better word?
Pardon?
Yeah, does it mean cover? I mean under the umbrella of their position, or?
Through the chair, it really means that they profess to have, they purport to have some lawful authority for taking this action, and color of law is the term that has been used to describe that purported authority that they are putting forth. For example, if you turn to the second page of Amendment Number 2, where, for your convenience, it sets out the existing crimes of official misconduct interference with constitutional rights under 1176.110.83. There is a phrase under color of law, ordinance, or regulation in the state or political subdivision. So it's a term that exists in other places, and it's the one that was chosen to make it clear that this is something done by someone, a governmental official who is professing to exercise some lawful authority. In other words, it's not simply just your next door neighbor knocking on your door saying, "I'm collecting all the guns." It's a police officer or National Guard or the state trooper.
So in essence, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to paraphrase this in my own thinking, is in essence they're acting on the capacity that they're professing to have, the authority that they have, and so therefore that's what this is the legal term for that?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Fertullo, is your questions for Mr. Guanelli?
Mr. Guanelli.
Go ahead, please.
Okay, just a couple of ones, Dean, thanks. I guess the first one would be, I think that you mentioned the National Guard. I think that they're going to be protected under orders and under the fact that they wouldn't be intentionally, they go to the door to get the gun. They've been ordered to do that. It turns out not to have been lawful, but they were under orders. I think they're protected. They aren't going to be prosecuted for this, am I right?
Through the chair, members and control, whether it's the National Guard or a state trooper taking orders, police officer taking orders from someone, I think the question is whether they believe that was a lawful order. And I know that always presents some difficulty in having subordinate officers thinking about whether the order is lawful, but it really is no different than if a superior officer ordered someone to go out and assault a citizen. They've got to think about the extent of the force they use and the orders that they're carrying out. So if they have reasonable grounds to believe that that was a lawful order, or let's put it this way, if they don't have any reasonable grounds to believe that it's unlawful, then they're probably protected. But if they're being told to go out and round up all the guns on this this block, they're gonna have to think about that. If they're told, that guy he's getting kind of mouthy with us, go out and tune him up is the phrase that's often used. They're gonna have to think carefully about that order as well.
Go ahead.
So the second thing I'm trying to get my mind around is when would it be lawful to confiscate guns? Just some examples of when it actually isn't.
Through the chair, I think that if a crime is being committed, certainly that's lawful. If there are two houses and there are shots being fired back and forth, I think that that getting hold of the weapons until you can figure out what's going on for a short period of time is appropriate. And that might even be extended to shots being fired from one building or another. But I think you have to gauge it based on the information that you have and how reasonable it is under the circumstances. And it simply has to be weighed against the right of citizens to ultimately protect themselves. So these are not going to be easy. I mean, it's not easy situations for the police to deal with, and it's not going to be easy for a prosecutor later to follow up and prosecute. But I think that a blank order to round up all the weapons in downtown Juneau is something that is not going to be permitted.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. Representative Stoltz.
Yeah. I think I'll pass on the question.
Okay. Representative Kelly.
Just a question, either of Mr. Guanelli or the maker of the motion for the amendment. Is disaster emergency meant to be disaster or emergency, or is it a term of art in itself, and if so, is it defined?
Through the chair, there is a definition for disaster. I'd have to think about whether it's disaster, disaster, emergency. I recall looking at this before, and I was satisfied that that it used the correct term, but.
It's okay. Mr. Chairman, I'll just trust you on that one. Just if it is the proper terminology and we know what that is, that's fine. I just thought there might, maybe we just missed an or there, but evidently not.
Through the chair, just that there is a definition of both disaster and disaster emergency in the definition section that appears at the end of Title 26. So, and specifically, disaster emergency is something that has been declared by proclamation of the governor to be a disaster, using the definition of what disaster is, which is also provided.
Thank you.
Any other questions for maker of the amendment, or for Mr. Quinella?
If I might, on the record, on the amendment as well, and it's always dangerous to open up your own amendments to further discussions, but again, this is a very sensitive issue here. This amendment is intended also to address the circumstance in which a, throw the hypothetical that there is a disaster emergency, the bad guys are rioting in the streets and looting. A law enforcement officer recognizes the circumstances. He knows that a citizen has firearms legally owned and possessed in their home. The citizen is not there to defend his home or his possessions, and the officer, in the interest, the overriding interest of public safety and in keeping the firearms from the hands of the marauding looters, secures those firearms effectively. I'm not a lawyer, but I could argue that's confiscating them, taking them from my home without my permission, but for the purpose of protecting me as an owner of those firearms and protecting the community as a whole. And I believe that is addressed in the structure of this amendment by saying that the officer does not forfeit his job, is not subject to the forfeiture of his position until convicted. And obviously then we have to go through the legal process where I believe somewhere, I'm a layman, I am not a lawyer, but I've got to believe that when it's brought to, if under the odd circumstances it's brought to court and it was my firearm confiscated, and I'm there testifying, I really appreciate Officer B for being in my home, protecting my firearms, and protecting the community by taking them into their custody. I just cannot imagine that the court would actually convict an officer under those circumstances. So I think we've sort of securitously got a way to protect officers acting in good faith, as well as providing due diligence, due process for the individual officer who may in fact have violated the intent of the law.
Okay. Very good. Mr. Grinnell, are you comfortable too with Representative Hawker's amendment and what he's attempting to do?
Mr. Chairman, I am, and I think his statement is certainly correct. I believe that that police officers always have the authority to take property into such a protective custody to prevent it from being stolen or misused. And I think if it's subject to being stolen, if it's in your home and you've vacated, you've abandoned your home, that certainly again doesn't jeopardize your Second Amendment rights because you've left your guns behind. So I concur with his statement.
Okay, very good. And Representative Kalka, you'd indicate you're okay with this amendment?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. And my main intent is if you deprive an individual who is a law-abiding citizen of their right, and I think this falls well within that.
Okay, very good. Then I'll remove my objection to amendment number two. So we have the bill before us as amended. Is there any other amendments to be made? Seeing none. There's no physical notes. I'm ready to go here.
Mr. Chairman, if I may make a comment on that. Essentially zero physical note or no physical note, it would appear to me, sir, that our legal system does not anticipate any increased prosecutions as a result of passing this, so I think that's an endorsement of our expectations of the quality of behavior on our elected officials, public officials, and law enforcement agencies. So I think that very relevant. I've been absolutely shocked to see a fiscal note attached to this bill, sir.
Would you like to move the bill, Representative Hawker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would. I would move from committee CS for House Bill number 400, Finance. Do we have an attached fiscal note?
As amended.
Zero fiscal note.
With attached zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Okay. Any objections? Seeing none, the bill passes out of committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Majority Leader. Okay, that concludes our business for this morning. We are going to meet again this afternoon. We will not be meeting Thursday and Friday, so we're doing double duty today, so we can have a few days off later on this week to go to the Energy Council or wherever you may be going. Next week, so get well rested, because the following week we do expect to be getting the PPT bill from Resources. As well as be taking up the operating budget. I believe all the subcommittees have closed. Is that right, Mr. Chairman?
All except one, I believe.
Okay. So we will be getting the operating budget shortly, as well as the PPT, so we'll be busy. But this afternoon, let's see, we have Senate Bill 218, Criminal Sentencing and Polygraphs. I believe that's both Senator Bundy and Representative Newman's bill, correct? Okay. And then House Bill 408, Definition of Child Abuse and Neglect, as well as House Bill 485, State Pharmacists, Doctors, Auditors. Okay, I believe that's it for today. So we are adjourned until 1:30 this afternoon.
I keep trying to, but they won't let me.
Yeah, we just call it the home.